there is so much push for change, and there is like a huge youth movement of young people, especially pushing for climate action. But the consequences are so much more deadly in the Philippines than here in terms of Filipino environmental journalists and activists. Like, there's multiple journalists who like live out there who have been murdered or killed, anti-coal activists who have been killed, indigenous activists who have been killed. So it's the stakes are a lot higher for activists there to be protesting compared to like the US, for sure.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline. Hi there, and welcome to Community Week. And this week, we're going to change the narrative around Thanksgiving by centering our community. So I'm really excited for you to be here. This is, again, day one of Community Week. It will be a series of conversations this week, so let's get started. Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you may be. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline podcast, the show where I engage with leaders in social movements, industries, and artists. And I really do this to have conversations that center the communities that are at the front line of climate change. And our community does this one conversation at a time. And so today I wanted to invite Christy Trudman, she, her pronouns, to the show. Welcome, Christy, to the show.
Hi, everyone.
Christy, just my audience may not know about you or the work you do, or even you as a person. So could you just tell me a little bit about what is it that you do in this journey called life?
Yeah. So hi, everyone. This is Christy Drutman. And I would say that this journey called life, I'm at a point where I am a podcast and a media creator. I have my own show called Brown Girl Green, where I interview environmental leaders and advocates about the importance of diversity and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. And on top of all of that, I am an educator. I love teaching and educating people about climate change, about climate justice. And I like just creating fun, entertaining bits of information that can make climate information and activism more accessible to a wider mainstream audience.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm curious to know, just because I've also never asked you this question, what's your favorite fruit or food?
Oh, it's always been sweet potatoes, honestly. I love sweet potato fries. I literally have a sweet potato like right next to me that I had for lunch. Sweet potato in any form, I think, is like for sure my favorite food.
Nice. Yeah, I like sweet potatoes too, so I can share that with you. So, hey, thanks for joining me. You know, in this show, I really try to hone in on language and the diction we use, because ultimately it could be one thing that divides us, or it could be something that brings us together.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you around just, Brown Girl Green is something that you started, and I was curious to know just if you could share a little bit of that story and how you came up with these specific words.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure I met you the same year I came up with Brown Girl Green, which is kind of like so mind-blowing. Like, that feels like a second ago, but it was like my senior year of college. And basically at that point, me and my friends had already created this group on campus called the Students of Color Environmental Collective at UC Berkeley, because essentially, backing it up a little bit, studying as a student around environmental science and environmental policy, and also interning for environmental organizations and doing environmental activism, I didn't really see other Filipino Americans or people who look like me in these spaces. And I had other friends who felt the same way, who came from, you know, immigrant families or, you know, like first gen, second gen immigrant families, and just felt like they didn't see people that look like them or represented their background in the climate or environmental space. And so we came together, created this group called the Students of Color Environmental Collective at UC Berkeley. And that was great. That was a great community space. It was like my start. It was like, okay, I'm going to create a space where there are conversations for people who felt like they've been traditionally excluded out of the mainstream environmental movement, whether that's like living a sustainable lifestyle or it's advocating for climate action. Yeah. It's very hard to find people who look like that. So that was the base. Then I attended this amazing conference called PGM1, People of the Global Majority, in the Outdoors, Nature, and Environment Conference. And it was like an all people of color like soiree where all these people came together and were actually talking about this same thing. But it was like my first ever experience being in a conference space with like-minded people. And in that space is when I met some mentors who I didn't know were going to be my mentors, who I was just like, how do we make this happen? How do we bring more Black, Indigenous, and people of color into the environmental conversation, environmental space? And a lot of them were like, you know, you have a great speaking voice. They're like, you should just start a podcast. So they actually, I don't remember who exactly it was, but it was a few people at that conference who were just like, you should just like do your own thing, like make your own show or something. I would listen to it because I said, like, I love storytelling. I love things like that. And I was like, that's not a bad idea. And so basically, I was like, I'm just going to come up with my own space, my own media platform where I can talk about these things. And that was pretty much the birth of Brown Girl Green, which is my story of being a brown girl, caring about the planet and wanting to find other people who feel like they've been left out of the conversation, too. So that way we can generate the conversations and the relationships and connections necessary to keep building this movement forward.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. And I know you've been across the world really to amplify your voice and the voice of people who don't have that opportunity, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious to know specifically, how is it that, tell me a little bit about this term and how you understand it, the term brown. What does that really mean to you?
Oh, I like this. I like this a lot. Okay. So I'm mixed race. So I'm Filipino. I don't like saying half. I guess it's a word podcast. So I don't like calling myself half anything. I mean, that really disintegrates my culture because I do feel full Filipino in my culture and my heritage. But I'm also mixed with Polish, Russian, Jewish heritage. So I come from both of those worlds. My mom's Filipino, my dad's Jewish, Polish, Russian. So totally different. Catholic, Jewish, such a mix. But I think the brown part is because despite having, you know, that those Jewish roots, and obviously it's a key part of my heritage, like I navigate the world as being brown. So I guess brown for me is like a signifier of, I'm like, how deep do we go with this? I guess it's like, yeah, a signifier of just like layers of like, I guess, I don't know, like having an immigrant background, like it's a signifier of like your family comes from definitely not like Protestant, white, Anglo-Saxon culture. You definitely like have roots in another country that's probably closer to the equator, where most people that live there are the same, around the same skin tone as you. But being brown also for me, I'm not light skin. I'm not like a light skin Filipino. So I like emphasizing that I'm brown because I view brown as like dark, because I am dark. And I think being brown has impacted a lot of the ways in which people perceive me, how I've had to navigate my own feelings around my own beauty standards for myself, being able to fit in or not fit in. So I think brown to me is a signifier for intergenerational trauma that I'm overcoming, trying to resolve and trying to really like step into with like confidence and like clarity.
Yeah, I like that. And I appreciate you sharing that because it could go really deep. And that wasn't necessarily my intention. I was just curious to know, you know, how you're understanding it, because in some ways, I think brown for me allows me to relate to people who you've described, as well as times in which brown has served as a different emotion, because it takes away the nationality or the story that comes with the immigrant path, right? Like if you say this person is brown, it's like, well, you know, where is that? You know, it could be really anywhere. It could be, you know, many times I'm people that don't know me will say, oh, you're from Mexico, right? And it's like, well, you know, there's even a story behind that, you know? So I was just really honestly curious about how you're understanding this term brown and ultimately how it shapes brown, girl, green. So thanks for sharing that. Tell me a little bit more about what some of the things you've learned or things that have surfaced as a result of having this podcast and having these types of conversations that are different than the mainstream movement, right?
Yeah. I think the main thing is just that the main thing that surfaced for me is that a lot of environmental justice organizations and people on the ground that have been doing this for a long time don't have resources. They don't have the kind of institutional or financial support that they deserve to be able to do really amazing work, like trying to demand for clean air, clean water, and a livable environment. And I think that as I've explored more of this work, it's becoming more and more apparent on the disparities around resource distribution between really big green NGOs and these like smaller on the ground grassroots organizations. Not to say that those big green NGOs are not doing great work or not doing anything. It's just like, what about these like neglected people on the ground that are primarily Black, Indigenous, and people of color? I think that's been really eye-opening to me, and I didn't realize that until I like went deeper into this work.
Yeah, there's some capacity building that's definitely needed.
Totally. And
I think even the conversations that I've had thus far, one thing that kind of has surfaced for me is that how because I was trained to be an environmental scientist, so like carbon, nitrogen, these were the things that were like drilled into me, you know? And I thought to myself, if I go back to Peru and start talking to the native people there about carbon and nitrogen, I'm going to straight up sound like a gringo, right? And to me, it brings up this other side of what is environmental work. Mm-hmm. And you had said, you know, how do we bring the BIPOC or native peoples into this movement or into this work? And I guess I would want to explore that a little bit more, because to me, it seems like it would be flipped, right? How do we get the mainstream folks to understand that the native people's practices, their culture, were inherently regenerative and sustainable? Explore that for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason why I frame it like that is because of Western colonization and oppression, and the reason that a lot of the stories and the work that many Black, Indigenous, and people of color have been doing has been decimated because of modern society. And although there's definitely people on the ground, especially, I mean, I can only specifically speak to like Indigenous peoples in the Philippines, like the Lumad in the Southern Philippines, for example, that I've done, you know, some work with. It's like they are already living like these very like sustainable, like in tune with earth practices, but it's being constantly challenged by this like corporate capitalist globalized notion on how to control resources. And so a lot of these communities around the world get unnoticed because they're not even mentioned in the mainstream media. Their lands get decimated, their people get killed because, you know, these big multinational, whatever, conglomerate, crazy things, you know, will come in and be like, we're going to mine and take your minerals and take your resources to, you know, build the modern world. And, you know, it gets murky because then these countries in the global south, like the Philippines, like, oh, well, we deserve to modernize too. So who are you to say we can't plunder indigenous lands to get minerals? And then it's just like all these things where it's like, we're not even talking about this. Like, unless you actually like go on YouTube and go deep in all these documentaries and all this stuff, it's like majority of the time, this stuff is very poorly covered. It's not being talked about. And I guess that's why I frame it that way, is that like those voices deserve to be heard, but Western society inherently has destroyed that. So it's like, how do we actually revive that and create a space for that to be nurtured, because it deserves to be nurtured, because that's what led us into this mess in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious to know, you know, doing podcasting could be also a very unique thing to do, right? Like you're using in some way minerals too, and lithium, for example, is used to do other things. And I'm sure at some point that's crossed your mind too. I know it crosses my mind often.
Oh, yeah.
I'm curious to know, you know, for those youth who are coming from these underprivileged backgrounds, who may be interested in also putting their voice out there. Yeah. What's your message to them as it relates to storytelling and diving into this journey that I think both you and I share, of like discovering these new things, not new things, but like, you know, quote unquote, and ultimately bringing to surface a different perspective that is missing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge technological gap, because it's like in an ideal world, we'd be able to have actual documentary filmmakers who are from the Amazon filming their own experiences and had the resources, the money, and like the connections to be able to bring that to a mainstream audience that actually looks like them. That's like in the ideal utopian world, like not just like white foundations or like just like people who have the money to like hire documentary filmmakers to fly huge helicopters to go into these places and ask, oh, can we interview? Not say it's not a black and white thing like that. That's not fair. But I'm just saying that. I'm just saying that, like, in an ideal world, like, we would be able to have more equipment and things supplied to storytellers that actually were directly in those communities themselves. Because at the end of the day, they can tell their story the best. They probably know who to interview, quote unquote, the best. And I just think overall, like, there needs to be a better distribution of resources, like trainings, education, storytelling workshops. Yeah, it's something that's been on my mind a lot, like in terms of like holding myself accountable with the work that I'm doing. It's definitely something that's been on my mind for a long time. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. And that's one thing I think that really pushed me into stepping into this space, because I was in rooms with executives where they were talking about climate frontline communities, like they were the experts. And to me, especially after traveling through a great part of Latin America and seeing those people who are at the front line, their stories were not the stories that were being told. And so when you start taking the narrative of someone else's family and someone else's people, you're changing who they are. And you know, obviously they're struggling, but there's also people who are like thriving in those situations, you know, and they're pushing forward. And I think when you capture those stories, you can also tell a different story than like carbon emissions are going up and we're going down and IPCC report is this and this kind of like negativity that comes with it, you know, it's different to me. And
at the end of the day, like, I don't know. I just think about people in the Philippines. I'm like, they're going to rebuild. You know what I mean? Like the Typhoon Goni or Roli, whatever you call it, that just hit. It's the strongest storm that's hit anywhere in the world this year in 2020 in the Philippines right now. Mm-hmm. And right now, like my friend, her family lives on the island. It's called Catanduanes. Anyways, all the electricity gone, obliterated. Like, they don't have electricity. They can barely get in touch with their friends and family members on their phones. And right now they're drinking only bottled water because there's no electricity or, you know, resources. And at the end of the day, though, they like already kind of are like, we're going to do this. we already like kind of are used to this. And it's like, we're going to have to keep really rebuilding back. And it's one of those things where I see in like the mainstream climate movement sometimes, it's like these frontline communities, like they're going to get decimated and like they're going to, and it's like, yes, that's true. But it's also like so complex on like, okay, but like, how are you actually listening to these people about what they need to rebuild back better when they've been asking for this for a long time? And yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I think it's like weirdly romanticized in a negative way, to group all of that together, because the front line looks different in all different regions. And I just don't think we have like, I don't know, extensive enough research or discussions about that outside of academia. And I think that's a problem for sure.
Yeah. And the social structures are completely different, right? Which makes them resilient in some ways that academia is never gonna research and find, you know?
Never.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, when you spend time outside the US in the Philippines, tell me what is the main difference between being out there and being in this place that often people refer to as the United States?
Oh, man. So I was just there in January before COVID hit. So I was there and I got in a really bad accident, like super bad, like near death accident. And I'm so glad I'm alive. Thank God. But basically, I had to deal with like, you know, Philippine healthcare system. And luckily, because I'm an American, I had the money and the privilege to be able to like access some of the best doctors and hospitals there. You know, all these things. And it's like so many people there do not and did not, because it's way too expensive and overpriced. So, and I learned that like many people in different islands outside of Manila have to like take ferries to go all the way to Manila several days, even if they're like near their deathbed, to go there because all the resources, are mostly concentrated there. Obviously there's some islands like, you know, in Cebu and some other places like in the southern Philippines that obviously do have facilities, but like the best ones are typically concentrated in the northern Philippines. And anyways, when I see that, it is one of those things where the disparities in access are so large that it's more obvious, whereas the US, it's like it's obvious, but it's also like subtle and it's also brushed under the rug. Whereas like the Philippines, like people are aware of it, but they kind of are like, well, we have to deal with this. It's like reality of the situation. But beyond that, that's like the negative stuff. The positive stuff that I've seen is just in general, like there is so much push for change. And there is like a huge youth movement of young people, especially pushing for climate action. But the consequences are so much more deadly in the Philippines than here. In terms of Filipino environmental journalists and activists, like there's multiple journalists who like live out there who have been murdered or killed.
Yeah.
Anti-coal activists who have been killed, indigenous activists who have been killed. So it's the stakes are a lot higher for activists there to be protesting compared to like the US for sure.
Yeah, which makes both of our work even more important, right? To be shining a spotlight in a place that is not getting the spotlight.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm curious to know what message you give youth that may be listening to you as they move on to a college career or whatever is up and they're thinking about their next step in life after high school or after college.
Yeah, I would say like learn how you can help others, because I think as you get older, the more and more you're going to be searching for purpose, and the less you have community or people that you're doing that with, the more lost you're going to feel. And so I think that the more that you can identify and search for purpose through community and finding out people who are hurting, finding out people you can help and how you want to help them, starting to ask yourself those questions at an earlier age, I think is going to be really beneficial in you finding meaning in the work that you're doing. And I mean, I know that's not everyone's priority or value. Obviously, a lot of people, that's a privilege to find meaning in the work that you're doing. But I think if you're able to and you have the privilege and the access to do so, finding meaning through community can be a really beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Okay. Last question as we wrap up, I'm curious to know, where is it that you get your inspiration and hope from?
This is a great question. I would say that, like, I get a lot of inspiration and hope from, I would say, like, my friends right now. My friends right now that are, like, you know, we're all in that space and are, like, I don't know, like, coming out of, like, being teenagers into, like, early, mid to late 20s, like, us, that group of people, like, just seeing the creativity and the excitement people are still having to advocate and talk about these things, especially for me on social media, has been really exciting. But also just, like, obviously it has died down, but definitely this past summer with, like, a lot of the waves of, you know, people waking up to caring about racial justice, you know, did give me a lot of hope. It died out. And I really hope that with everything that's happening this week, that, like, people wake up again. I hope there's, like, I hope it's, like, a wave and then it goes down and then it goes up. But I hope it just, like, stays consistent at a baseline.
Just so listeners know, right now we still don't know who the next president is, and we're kind of waiting, and that's when we're having this conversation.
Yes, yeah, we don't know yet. So it's really terrifying. And yeah, I think I have a lot of hope, though, that, like, we've built a somewhat of a baseline. I don't know if that baseline is like legit, but I'm, like, really hanging on to it being legit. And I hope that more people are recognizing that we live in a very, like, racially divided. I don't even know how to word it. It's, like, such a mess.
There's a lot of work to do.
There's a lot of work to do, in summary. And I think we're realizing that with everything going on. And we need more people who are willing to name the injustices and be able to speak up.
Yeah. And I know that you're doing your part to be able to amplify that. So what's the best way for folks to find out about you and what and the things that you do?
Yeah, so you all can check out browngirlgreen.org. You can follow me on Instagram, browngirlgreen, or check out the Brown Girl Green podcast or YouTube channel. That's where you can find me. I'm also Christy Drutman on LinkedIn if you want to get more professional.
Any last messages or words of wisdom you'd like to share with my audience?
Yeah, just that, like, we need more storytellers, especially if you come from a community that probably is opposed to climate change or doesn't think it's a real thing. We don't have time to waste. And I know that I cannot be the only storyteller out there. We need more people out there, more listeners like you, to take action, and your story matters. So I hope you can take a moment to recognize yourself for that, that you do have a story to tell, and figure out the best way for you to tell that.
Okay, Christy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Christy, aka Brown Girl Green. I've known Christy for a couple of years now, so I'm really excited that we have an opportunity to share this conversation with you. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or simply send me an email just letting me know what your takeaways are from this conversation. We are found in all podcasting platforms, as well as on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I will see you tomorrow for day 2. Bye now. The communities who are experiencing the worst effects of climate change are those who are best positioned to innovate solutions. Thank you for tuning in and being part of Changing the Narrative. See you next time at the Climate Frontline.